Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Football Show.
Welcome to the Athletic Football Show. Today's Thursday, December 23rd. I'm Robert Mays. Great show for you guys today. Our Browns writer at The Athletic, Zach Jackson, is going to be joining us a little bit later. Before we get to Zach, though, I'm thrilled to welcome my good friend, Lindsay Jones. Lindsay, how you doing?
I am great. Getting ready for Christmas.
It's sneaking up on me this year, it feels like.
It's
sneaking up on me. Yeah. We were supposed to go to New Jersey to see my fiance's family on Christmas night, because typically I fly the day after Christmas, but the day after Christmas is a Sunday this year. Can't do a lot of flying on Sunday. I don't know if you know this, but I work on Sundays. So it's a little bit difficult for me to travel. So we were going to do that, and now we are not because of the everything about the world. So I'm going to be able to spend all of Christmas and all of Christmas evening with my family and my brothers and my mom, and I'm very much looking forward to that. But I don't know. For whatever reason, it feels like it happened very quickly this year. It feels like Thanksgiving just happened.
It's weird that it's on a weekend, too, because it is very much overlapping with all of our NFL stuff. Like, sometimes it falls in the middle of the week and there's these weird practices, but we're going to get to not only spend this weekend Christmas with our actual families, we're going to get to spend it with Aaron Rodgers and Jonathan Taylor and Kyler Murray. So that'll
we'll get into one of those games a little bit later. It's going to be, spoiler alert, part of our appointment viewing. We're also going to do another segment of Staying Alive about the Minnesota Vikings as we continue to pore over all of the teams that are somehow still in the NFL playoff picture. I wanted to start, though, with something that I thought of yesterday while watching the Rams play the Seahawks. And we're not going to talk about those games. By the time this comes out, it's going to be Thursday morning. It'll be 2 days since that game has happened. You guys all watched it. We'll dig into game analysis on Sunday night the same way we typically do. But I was watching Cooper Kupp dominate last night. I wanted to have each of us lay out the argument for why a non-quarterback could win the MVP this year. I want to preface this by saying this is not going to happen. I don't believe it should happen, but I still think it's worth kind of playing devil's advocate and putting this hat on every once in a while. The same way that people make an argument or make a case for somebody going into the Hall of Fame, right? Where you have to lay it out for everyone in the room. I wanted each of us to make an argument for Jonathan Taylor or Cooper Kupp as the MVP of the NFL in this very strange season where no quarterback has really taken it and run with it.
Well, and I was really excited when you pitched this to me because it's been about 3 weeks or so, I think, since we did kind of the MVP race discussion where we pretty much only talked about quarterbacks, because at that point, it really was kind of a very quarterback driven race. And it's shifted a lot in the last couple of weeks. I mean, I think Aaron Rodgers has probably taken control, and he was the one guy we did not talk about basically at all in that discussion. But here we are now after week 15, and Aaron Rodgers is probably in the driver's seat.
I'm not sure how he's going to win it after being canceled.
Well, he anti-cancel culture. And I will say, watching Aaron Rodgers on Christmas is basically going to be like sitting with your random anti-vax family members. So it really is fitting. But because none of these quarterbacks have really pulled away, it really is opening the door for guys like Jonathan Taylor and Cooper Kupp, who are having potentially historic seasons, but also are so critical to, you know, their team's fates right now. And if this is a best player on the best team type of award, which so often the MVP award is, both of these guys have a legitimate case.
Well, so let's just think about this right now. So if you're looking at BetMGM at this very moment, Jonathan Taylor is plus 750. Those are the third best odds in the league, and he's a running back.
That's
Cooper Kupp's odds right now, it's 3,500, which are still pretty long odds. The same as Justin Herbert. Cooper Kupp right now has better betting odds to win the MVP than Dak Prescott. So even if it's a far off remote possibility for these guys to do it, the fact that we have a running back and a receiver that are even in this discussion at this stage of the year, I think speaks to the seasons that those guys are having. So why don't you get us rolling here? I want you to lay out for me why Cooper Kupp could be the MVP of the NFL.
Well, have you watched Cooper Kupp? That's the
I have thing. Watched Cooper Kupp this year, yes.
So the case for Cooper Kupp is that he is potentially having the greatest single season by any wide receiver ever. And that's a pretty broad statement because there have been some really, truly incredible seasons by wide receivers. You know, Jerry Rice had a couple of them, 1987, 1995. 1987, he had 22 touchdowns in 12 games. Like, that is insane, right? You know, it's tough to compare receiving eras or receiving seasons because of the eras of football are so completely different. But he is as dominant right now in 2021 as Jerry Rice was in 1987 or in 1995, or as Calvin Johnson was in 2012 or Randy Moss in 2007. He is putting up those type of just bonkers stats. And yes, Cooper Kupp is going to get a 17th game, but it is not out of the realm of possibility that he could break Calvin Johnson's single season receiving yardage record within 16 games. He needs something like 160 yards each of the next 2 weeks to get there. But if you've watched Cooper Kupp recently in the Rams offense, that is certainly a possibility. And to think that, you know, if he stays healthy for three more weeks, that it almost is a foregone conclusion that he'll set the single season receiving record, should go over 2,000 receiving yards. And that touchdown mark, he's got 14 right now. He had two on Tuesday night that, you know, I don't know if he's going to get to 23 or whatever, but he could possibly get there. So if
it's 18, that's still a ridiculous historical season.
Yeah, absolutely. So he's hitting like kind of every single like traditional receiving benchmark and exceeding it. And then he's also he's also there on some of the advanced metrics. We were looking at some of these stats earlier that he's first in yards per route run right now. And not just that he's first in the league, he's first by a pretty significant margin over the next best player, who's Deebo Samuel. But you went and found that it's the best in 10 years. For basically as long as they've been tracking.
Since 2010. And if you look at PFF, and then we have it on True Media as well, for yards per route run, the only other person to crack three for an entire season, actually there are two guys that have cracked three that are kind of high volume guys since 2010. One is Julio Jones, who did it 3 years in a row. I don't think we understand how good Julio Jones was, just how efficient Julio Jones was as a receiver for so long. He did it 3 years in a row, and Andre Johnson did it in 2012. That's it. Calvin didn't do it the year he broke the record. It hasn't happened in several seasons. Davante Adams didn't do it last year when he was having that first team all-pro year. This isn't just a volume thing.
Yeah.
This isn't that Cooper Kupp has gotten dozens of more targets than everybody else. He's doing so much whenever he's on the field. And the one other stat I wanted to throw out that I didn't give you, but I'm looking at right now. If you look at total EPA on plays where that player is targeted this season, okay? Cooper Kupp is at 77.2. The next closest guy is Justin Jefferson at 56.7. It's a 3-touchdown gap.
And I want to be clear that Justin Jefferson is really freaking good.
Yes.
So the fact that, that's the gap between first and second there is really crazy. But I want to say the other thing is like, so the statistics are ridiculous.
Really quickly, before you move on, the gap between Cooper Kupp and Justin Jefferson is larger than the gap between number 2 and number 15, which is DeAndre Hopkins. That's how much better Cooper Kupp has been than the field this year.
It's
anyway,
just wild. Continue. So, you know, I was going to say, so the statistics alone are ridiculous. I mean, he's putting together an offensive player of the year type. In any other year, he would be like the runaway favorite for offensive player of the year. The fact that Jonathan Taylor exists will make that really, really interesting over the next few weeks. But it's not just that he's putting up these crazy numbers. It's that he is literally doing everything. He is not like the type of receiver that you pigeonhole is like, he is only our deep threat guy. He is only our slot guy. He is, you know, only a third down possession receiver. He is all of those things. And the way that he and Sean McVay and Matthew Stafford to an extent, but there's just something that's been really, really cool about the way that Kupp and McVay this year are on this like other plane when it comes to like play design and the way that they're figuring out ways for him to get open than the physical, just freakish natural ability that Kupp has to get open on his own. But it's just created this really kind of perfect storm of new and creative play design. The work that they're doing in the red zone has been pretty incredible. I've seen the Rams live 2 times this year, and it has happened to be like 2 of their best games. It was when they played the Bucs in week 3 and then Monday Night Football against the Rams a couple of weeks ago. And I've been lucky enough to sit next to Jordan Rodrigue, our colleague who covers the Rams. And she has been chronicling like all of the really cool shit that they've been doing. And you sit there and you watch him, and at least 2 or 3 times a game, you just go, what? How did he do that? One, how did he get that open? How did he make that catch? It's not just that McVay is scheming up ways to get him open. There is a little bit of that, but Kupp is doing so much of this on his own. And it was really interesting to hear the comments from Sean McVay and Matthew Stafford after the Tuesday night game against Seattle, where Cooper Kupp won them that game, right? I mean, it was a really tough kind of situation there, but he scored both of their touchdowns in a 20-10 win. And both of these guys are like, he is just doing something that we've never seen before. And he's so spectacular the way that he is taking over games. And for Matthew Stafford to say that, Matthew Stafford was Calvin Johnson's quarterback.
Yeah.
When Calvin Johnson set the single season receiving record. Calvin Johnson only had 5 touchdowns that year.
It's just bonkers. I want to say that weird? He got tackled at the 1-yard line like 5 or 6 times.
A few times. Was that the year that he like didn't catch a touchdown when he should have, and it was the Calvin Johnson?
Maybe that was it. There's been a lot of fantasy sadness with Calvin Johnson and Julio Jones over the years.
But that would be kind of a fun, you know, if a weird trivia question eventually, if and when Cooper Kupp becomes the single season receiving leader, sets that record that Matthew Stafford was the quarterback in both of those. I will say there's a bit of a narrative thing here too, because we talk about it all the time. Anytime you and I discuss the MVP, there is a narrative element to this. There's a human element to what voters are considering. And he does have kind of an interesting story, just the way that he was scouted, the way that he came in. He came from Eastern Washington. He wasn't, you know, he didn't come from LSU or Alabama. He didn't quite have that same pedigree, but it's been really interesting to kind of learn more. And a lot of this is thanks to Jordan's reporting about the way that the Rams scouted him and the things that they liked about him. It was a very data-driven scouting process. The way that they were able to kind of track his speed, his speed out of breaks, the way that he played with pads on didn't necessarily line up with like straight up combine numbers. So,
the
you know,
4.62 he ran in Indy.
Right, exactly. Where, you know, the Rams are sitting there just like laughing because they're like, we know something about this guy that nobody else does. So I do think he does have kind of an interesting, you know, there is an interesting story. Should we get into the reasons why he won't win? The things that are maybe working against him.
I want to talk about Kupp, just the kind of the idiosyncrasies to his game for a second, as just how unique of a player that he is. Because when you watch him, he has spent about 2/3 of his snaps in the slot this year, but he's not just a slot receiver.
Yeah.
We've talked about this on the show, me and Nate. I mean, I was blown away when I realized this year. I can't believe it took me until this year to realize it. I can't believe he's 6'2". And then when you watch some of the stuff that he does, that frame really shows up. The contested catches, the fact that his frame is big enough where he's really making plays outside of his body and what that allows him to do as a receiver. His hands are insane. I mean, the balls that he is able to come down with and just how many plays he makes that aren't necessarily gimme plays, the fact that he's a vertical threat, he's affecting the game just in so many different ways. And his awareness and sense for how to set stuff up, the way the coverage structures look, all of that kind of stuff. The numbers look great. The eye test looks great. He isn't going to be this eye-popping, run past you, I am a physical specimen type of player, but that almost makes the success he has at this position specifically even more interesting.
I'll just say the things that are maybe working against
him. Let's hear it.
The hardest things right now. Okay, so the first thing is that all those other receivers that I mentioned, specifically Jerry Rice, none of those guys have won the MVP award. A receiver has never won this award. Apparently a kicker has won the NFL MVP.
Mark Mosley, it was the strike year.
So, and so a receiver hasn't. So it's a pretty big block, I think, for like voters to get past, you know, where it's a lot harder, I think, for a receiver to make that case. So that is probably the biggest reason that he's not going to win this award. And the fact that, look, there's Jonathan Taylor, who we're about to talk about, is also having this like ridiculous impact as a not from the non-quarterback position. But I think the other thing that makes his case a little bit difficult is the team that he plays on. And that he's on this very star-driven team. And Matthew Stafford has definitely, that three-game losing stretch that they went through, I think he played himself out of the MVP conversation, but he's kind of a dark horse MVP candidate. There are going to be questions about how much of Cooper Kupp's success is because of it's scheme-driven, how much of it is Sean McVay, where I think it's very much not an either-or, like it's a both of them contribute equally to this. But I think that might be a little bit of it there, where some of these other guys were like, especially you could look at Jonathan Taylor, where like it is very clear who is doing what here and his kind of singular contributions to that offense, where he is carrying that team, where there could be potentially other guys on the Rams that you could make a case for Aaron Donald, you know, being an MVP type of candidate, a guy who will dominate and win you games that maybe some of these other guys won't be facing.
I think the argument for the receiver over a running back is that for the receiver, there are even fewer moving parts associated with their success, right? I mean, if you're just getting open, all you need is the quarterback to get you the ball. I mean, I guess you could make an argument that you need a line to hold up long enough, but it's not the same as a running back. The argument against a running back winning MVP and against running back value in general over the last several years, and it's a good argument, is that a running back needs so many other things to go right for him to be successful, right? You need a play that's well blocked. You need a really good offensive line. There's just so many other factors that dictate running back success that it's hard to say a running back can be that valuable. I'm going to try, though.
Let's go.
Let's start with the fact that the Colts are far and away number one in the NFL in rushing efficiency. On a per rush EPA, they are three times as good as the next best team in football. Okay, they are first in rushing DVOA. Just they are an outlier in terms of how good they've been running the football this year. And if you look at it, they're 10th in offensive DVOA right now. They're 20th throwing the ball. Their place as a top 10 offense in the league is driven by Jonathan Taylor. The big question to me as I was digging through a lot of this, and I'll have several examples, how is this different than what Derrick Henry did last year? Why is this season from Jonathan Taylor more impressive than what Derrick Henry did a year ago? If you look at what that Titans offense was last year, it was a top five offense. They're fourth in passing DVOA. They were not even the most efficient rushing offense in the league last season. A huge part of the Titans' success. Yes, is Derrick Henry crucial to that engine? We've seen what they are without him now. But their passing game was unbelievably efficient for the last couple of years. That's not the case with the Colts. You could make an argument that one of the only reasons the Colts are a viable playoff team right now is because of their running game, and in large part because of Jonathan Taylor. So if you look at early in the season, right, some of the numbers associated with the Colts rushing attack, they were number one in EPA, but they were down there in success rate. They weren't necessarily churning out moderate gains and consistent yardage in the run game. That has shifted. Jonathan Taylor's success rate this season is 47.8%, which is the best among qualified high-volume running backs. So not only is he ripping off these monster gains, I think he has twice as many 20-yard runs as anyone else in the league. He's also the most consistent runner in the league right now. He is consistently getting the type of yardage the Colts offense needs to stay on schedule. He is number one, and this is the big thing for me. If we're trying to separate running back success from overall offensive structure success and offensive line success, that's very hard to do, but there are stats that try to do it. He is number one in the league in rushing yards over expected per attempt. It's 1.58. No one else is above 1.28. His first downs per carry are 34.4%. That's fourth in the NFL. The three guys ahead of him, all quarterbacks. Josh Allen, Jalen Hurts, Lamar Jackson. What he's doing to create new series, to create explosive plays, but also both getting what's blocked and getting more than what's blocked, his success, I think you can say, is more than just the offensive line, than just what's being blocked for him. He's going above and beyond that. And to me, this is the really big one, because it's not just efficiency numbers. It's not just rate stats that I think you have to look at. Jonathan Taylor this year has produced 36.11 total EPA rushing the ball. That is 60 points better than most of the guys around him that have gotten the same efficiency. Your Joe Mixon's, your Dalvin Cook's, 60 points. Last year, Derrick Henry produced 15.61 EPA for the season. That's a difference of 21 points where Jonathan Taylor is right now compared to where Derrick Henry was last year. It's not just that he's the most efficient running back. It's that he's been an efficient player. He's been so good this year that the Colts can sustain offensive success with him as their number one weapon in a way that very few teams can with their running back. And that to me is why he kind of steps outside of other conversations we've had about how impactful a running back can be, how impactful a running game can be. He's consistently getting more than what's blocked, and his overall impact on the game is outsized even when you compare him to the better running back seasons we've seen over the last 5 years.
Can you make the opposite argument about why? Is there anything specifically about Jonathan Taylor that you would say, oh, maybe voters will have pause here, that other than it's just the running back value, about why he might not win?
I think the reputation his offensive line has, I think, is going to go a long way in this, right? I mean, you have an offensive line full of former first-round picks, of all pro-type talents. When you talk about Quentin Nelson, you know, Ryan Kelly was a first-round pick. Braden Smith just got extended. Eric Fisher was the number one overall pick. When you think about the best offensive lines in the league, I think their performance this year isn't necessarily in line with the reputation they carried into this season for a lot of different reasons. Quentin Nelson's been banged up. Eric Fisher didn't even start at the beginning of the year, and I think that it's taken him a little bit to come along. Braden Smith's been dinged up. But as he's really started to dominate is when that line has been intact. I know Ryan Kelly has missed some time recently for a really tragic personal reason, but for the most part, you have a very good group in front of him. And I think that would be the knock against him. But I just think that when you look at his prominence within the success of his team and the fact that he's driving so much of it, and those explosive runs and the home runs, and the fact that, again, the success rate is so incredibly high, I do think this is slightly different than some of the other running back considerations we've seen over the last few years. I think the road is way, way, way too tough, and the climb is way too steep for this to happen. But I do think he's making as good a case as you possibly could at that position.
I think the thing that's going to be tough for him is that there's been kind of like a clear historical precedent of what it takes for a running back to win the MVP award. And it's kind of that 2,000 yard benchmark where you're doing something fairly historic statistically. I think that might work against him. I am very curious to watch him Saturday night. That he has another primetime game.
Big stage, baby.
So, and he's playing against a Cardinals run defense that is not great. So this is, it could set up for like a very big MVP moment type of stage for him. And their last two games, they're playing the Raiders and the Jags. There's not going to be a ton of national eyeballs, I think, on either of those games. So this is kind of the platform for him. This is the time. Look, Aaron Rodgers is going to have a primetime game. He could potentially have one of those MVP moments that will sway a lot of opinions and maybe shift the conversation around this race. But I'm very excited to watch him against the Cardinals. And I think that's something we'll talk a little bit. We're going to get a little bit more into that matchup coming up.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I have set this up as the biggest possible reverse jinx that I can, because I'm playing against Jonathan Taylor in my fantasy semifinals on Saturday, and I'm just trying to do everything I can.
You're
to
screwed,
swing
buddy.
Swing the cosmic elements in my way. Oh, I'm so screwed. I also have Austin Eckler and Travis Kelce on my team, which their health is first and foremost the most important thing, but also not the best timing for me.
Well, let's get into all of that, right? Because this is another week where, unfortunately, COVID is going to be the main storyline of this week. Hopefully not to the extent that it was last week when three games had to be postponed, but that's still in the realm of possibility here in week 16, because despite the protocol changes that the NFL made over the last week or so, there are still multiple teams with pretty significant COVID outbreaks going on, including the Kansas City Chiefs, who their outbreak seems to be under control in Kansas City. There were no new positives reported on Wednesday, but they do have more than 10 players on the list. And that list includes Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill, you know, only two of the best players.
Yeah, you know, they seem like they're decently useful.
Yeah. So that completely changes the complexion of who they are on offense. So this is just another week where we're all going to kind of have to just like hold our breath, wear our masks, stay inside, get tested. But the NFL is kind of just trying to figure out if they can kind of keep this season on track. And the fact that they moved games last week is going to put a lot of teams, these teams that are having outbreaks, the Houston Texans, the Baltimore Ravens, into positions where they're going, well, what about us? Are you going to move our game? What's the standard? You know, what kind of comes next? Because last week was really messy. There were a lot of moving parts. And they haven't kind of gotten all of this COVID stuff under control, just like this whole country hasn't. I mean, you see numbers exploding all around. The NBA has been canceling games. The NBA is considering protocol changes. The NHL is kind of a mess. College football, I mean, Texas A&M had to back out of a bowl game, and Wake Forest is looking for an opponent if maybe the Jacksonville Jaguars want to step in and play a bowl game. You know, this is not exclusive to the NFL right now.
It's a great move by the Jags. I mean, you just get your guys feeling good, get a win,
see the ball go in
a couple times. Yeah, I mean, it feels like a really smart move on their part. What did you make of what J.C. Treader said today about the league wanting to cancel those games and the union saying that they wanted those games to be played? I mean, obviously, he has incentive to make it seem like he got those guys paid, but I'm curious what your response was to that.
Yeah, so it's interesting because the NFL laid this out with NFLPA signing off on it back last summer, where they made it possible that games could be canceled in 2021 and they would be considered forfeits because based on a team not being able to play, and that it was incumbent on the teams to make all the roster moves and everything they needed to do to be able to play these games. But it was also kind of dictated by the fact that they assumed that cancellations would be because of outbreaks that were caused by unvaccinated players. And that was very much not the case in Washington, in LA, or in Cleveland, where J.C. Treader, the NFLPA president, plays. In all three of those cases, in the Browns, I believe all of the players who tested positive and their staff members were all vaccinated. Washington was mostly vaccinated. LA was, I believe, mostly, if not all vaccinated, including some people who had already had their booster shots. So the NFL was not really prepared for what to do about moving games or potentially canceling games when there were, you know, none of us could have seen this, right, in July, that it was going to be these outbreaks caused by vaccinated asymptomatic people testing positive.
What can you do? I mean, you've done everything you can at that point. I mean, if you've taken the necessary precautions and you're following the protocols, it feels so silly to punish those teams.
So, yeah, I mean, and all of those games that got moved had significant playoff implications. These were not, it wasn't, you know, Jags Jets or some game that doesn't really matter at this point of the season. So I get why the PA wanted them played. And the PA, look, the PA wanted them to be played because if they would have canceled the games under the way the protocols were written, none of those players would have gotten paid. So something like 18% of the NFLPA player population would have had to give up game checks last week. That is a significant amount of money for a significant amount of people. I just think they're trying, you know, the NFL is trying to just figure this out on the fly and try to apply some of the 2020 standards and precedent that they set last year. But this is a completely different situation and they're trying to adapt and be ahead of this. And it's just really, really challenging. I'm glad those games were played, even though, I mean, I think some of those teams, the Browns, were in a really bad situation with a third string quarterback. So was Washington having to play Garrett Gilbert on Tuesday night. I'm glad those guys got paid. I just wish there was some other way that, you know, it was not like forfeit or nothing. But there was a lot of pressure. There were a lot of really interesting conversations going on behind the scenes. Teams that didn't want to play and would have gone to pretty great lengths to, I'm trying to think out the right way to say this. Like they would have played, but not really played, so that they didn't have to take a forfeit, but that they wouldn't also have to put their players in a really bad situation with all backups playing. I mean, it was the behind the scenes. I think the postmortems when we kind of get after the season and people are really willing to talk about what happened over the last few days are going to be really interesting.
Anything that you feel like people should know just so they have a baseline of information for how to react to these things as they're coming out?
Yeah, sure. So I was on the Football GM with Mike Sando and Randy Mueller. We recorded that Friday afternoon right before they ended up moving those games. Saturday afternoon was when the NFL formally updated their protocols, where the significant change was they're no longer going to be doing regularly testing vaccinated asymptomatic people. So what they're doing instead is they're doing, they're going to test anybody who's symptomatic. So you have a sore throat, you have a cough, you have a fever, a bad headache, any of those sorts of things, you're going to get tested.
Out of curiosity, what is the thought with testing less if they assume there are going to be more cases? Because that seems counterintuitive on its face.
Yeah, so it's multi-pronged. It's kind of complicated here. But one is they have a lot of data, especially coming out of the last couple of weeks, where when they've had a lot of asymptomatic vaccinated people who have tested positive. And what they're finding is that they are able to test back in much more quickly. The viral load is much smaller. So the likelihood that they're spreading it is less. It doesn't mean they're not spreading it. That is not the case necessarily here. But the problem was that there were just so many cases, given what Omicron is like, is that there's just a lot more people catching it. It's very highly contagious, but also very mild to asymptomatic and vaccinated people. So that's kind of how that is working right now. Guys also can test voluntarily if they want to, if they're nervous, if they're afraid they were exposed. They also can do at-home testing. And if, let's say, your wife or your child or your nanny, whoever it is, might be positive because that's going on in the community right now, you can also get tested. So this is a pretty big shift in the way that pro sports are going to be handling this. Looks like the NBA is probably going to be doing something similar. I think Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, today told ESPN that they're even considering a protocol change where asymptomatic vaccinated players who test positive won't have to quarantine at all and they can continue playing. So, you know, the NFL took a ton of heat over the weekend for saying, oh, they're waving the white flag on COVID. They're not going to test. What sense does this make? But they're going to be hardly alone in this. And it's going to be a really, really interesting couple weeks to see how this all plays out.
Oh boy. Well,
buckle up.
I'm sure we'll be tracking it all as it happens.
Get your booster, wear your mask, get tested before you hang out with lots of people over the holidays. That's all I got.
I'll be hanging out with lots of people. Well, family. That's really it. The concert I was supposed to go to in Brooklyn next week is not happening anymore, unfortunately.
I mean, I didn't go to the Broncos-Bengals game last week, even though I had a credential. And I was like, I just don't want to sit in a crowded press box. So I get it. We're all kind of just trying to figure this out as we go along right now.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Staying alive, staying alive.
All right. It's time for this week's edition of Staying Alive, where we dig into the prospects and playoff prospects of one of the many, many teams that is still mathematically alive in the playoff race. And we're going to talk about the Minnesota Vikings today, who are 7-7 and currently the number 7 seed in the NFC. You could have told me they were the 11th seed. I know there are a bunch of teams that were 7-7. I have no idea who's winning the tiebreakers, who's not. This is all stuff that we'll start figuring out when it's really necessary, like 2 weeks from now. You thought that me wanting to talk about the Vikings today was a ploy to make you watch the Bears from Monday night, which it was not.
Because I had boycotted that game. I watched most of the primetime games with my daughter, and I saw a couple minutes of that, and I was like, no, I'm not doing this to her. She still likes football, so I am not making her watch this game because I want her to like football. I don't want her to see whatever this is that is going on. And here you are making me rewatch this game. And I did. I went through it a couple times, and man, I'm sorry you sat through that in person the other night.
You know what? I had a nice time. The football was terrible, but I had a nice time.
But you left that game like remembering why you like loved football and going to games, right?
Yeah. That's how much of a sicko I am. At this point, I mean, the Bears can't hurt me anymore. It's all about the other elements to it. Okay.
I hope you at least like got a good meal, enjoyed some ambiance, got some good...
I enjoyed the ambiance. No good meal. I had like a couple peanuts. I didn't want to ruin my day because I wasn't planning on going. It's like, I'm not going to eat like crap and just have another bad day. I had some peanuts and I sat with my brother. It was very nice. All right. We start all of these conversations with a simple question. Why would the Vikings make the playoffs? How could the Vikings make the playoffs? What are the reasons working in their favor?
So the first argument about why the Vikings could make the playoffs is that we have seen stretches of very good Kirk Cousins, and they're going to get Adam Thielen back, it sounds like, this week when they play the Rams. And if you beat the Rams, all of a sudden, everything looks a lot better. But so much of this depends on good Kirk showing up and not bad Kirk. But we're thinking positive right now. This is why they could make the playoffs, right? So it's if you get the very good version of Kirk Cousins.
It's the version we saw against the Packers.
Sure.
If you get the version offensively that we saw against the Packers, that team can beat some people. That team could theoretically beat the Rams. The Vikings are 7th in passing DVOA. It feels like we're on year 8 of, is Kirk Cousins good? Like it feels like we're that's just a constant question that we're asked. There are so many caveats to that, right? The amount of heavy boxes that the Vikings see and the amount of simple coverages that the Vikings see because their running game looks a certain way. It's very hard in a vacuum to understand exactly how good Kirk Cousins is. But when you look at the final product, the Vikings passing game has very high highs. And if they get Thielen back, you watched that game last week. I thought the Bears' secondary was remarkably good considering it was all backups. I don't know where they were hiding Thomas Graham for this entire season, but I want to see more of him. And if you look at just the structure they were playing defensively, they were not going to let Justin Jefferson beat them. I mean, the one big play that he had, they were playing quarters in the red zone, and he essentially had a one-on-one with the safety by virtue of the way that they lined up. The Vikings did a really good job of identifying zone, had him one-on-one, corner out, touchdown. For the most part, though, I mean, the Amir Smith-Marset touchdown happened because three guys stuck with Justin Jefferson in the red zone when he was lined up in the backfield. They were not going to let Justin Jefferson beat them. That strategy becomes less viable when Adam Thielen is back in the game. Christian Darrisaw is back playing, which I think is a good thing for this team. You saw the kind of the ripple effect of when he was out and they had to move Udo to left tackle. That was a disaster. So this offense getting healthier and us seeing those high highs of their potential passing game, I think is the reason that they could do it. The defense is a question. We'll talk about that. But that to me is the root of the argument is that Justin Jefferson is really good. We've seen what this passing game can do when everybody is around.
Why do I have a feeling that this is like an Aaron Donald just destroys the Vikings' playoff hopes in one
game. Aaron Donald has had his way with Mason Cole before, and Mason Cole is currently playing guard for the Vikings, so I think that could be an issue.
So I guess that's the argument of why they won't make the playoffs, right? Or the case.
Well, the argument for why they won't is that the offense has been pretty volatile, you know, within games even. And now you have the Kirk Cousins question of if they can string together multiple games. And I think the other side of this is it's a tough road. I mean, the Rams are a very good team. We know this. And they have the Packers. I mean, the Rams and the Packers are their next two. They're 7-7 right now. They have the seventh seed in the NFC. But there's a reason that if you look at 538, the Vikings have like a 25% chance to make the playoffs and the Saints have like a 47% chance. It's because of the schedule that the Vikings have the rest of the way. So I think the schedule is one part, and also the defense is just in rough shape, man. And this defense is 21st in weighted DVOA. They released a starting cornerback last week because he got into a scuffle and an argument at practice with the coaching staff and multiple people. I mean, that's just looking at that and the guys they've lost. Somehow this team leads the league in sacks, which makes no sense to me, but they have no edge rushers anymore. You know, they've had to kind of piece together elements of their secondary. You know, they've gotten guys back like Eric Kendricks, Anthony Barr, who've been in and out of the lineup, but it still feels like overall that defense has a lot of holes and a lot of concerns. So if the offense isn't winning a potential shootout like they could against the Packers, I'm just not sure that this team is going to be able to compete against really good teams.
Yeah, and you just have no confidence in them in a close game situation at all.
Yeah. I mean, it would, based on the way that this season has gone, it's hard to. Another relevant question we always ask here. Do the Vikings actually want to make the playoffs? And I think there are a couple different ways that you can go with this. What is your knee-jerk answer? Do you think the Vikings actually want to make the playoffs?
Okay, look, if you're a Vikings fan, yes. Probably.
Ooh.
Right?
I'm going the other way.
Oh, because you just want like a complete teardown rebuild.
Correct. If you're Mike Zimmer, you absolutely want to make the playoffs.
Well,
because
do
if you?
You
don't.
Do you?
He could be freed from this.
Last week we did our in our power rankings, we did kind of like a worst case scenario, like fan fiction for every team. And I basically just I just wrote a thing where I had Mike Zimmer just throwing off his headset, slamming down a clipboard and just like marching out into the wilderness and being
God.
This is it. I'm done.
Just
free
him from
I'm
this
done.
Prison, this head yeah. coach shaped prison that he's built for
which
himself.
Which might actually be his best case scenario. He's going to go back to his house that has 800 animal heads on the walls and just like
in Kentucky, right? Isn't that where it is?
Yeah, I mean, it'd just be a better life. He just wouldn't have to deal with like kickers missing last second kicks. And
oh, see, I want to see him be a defensive coordinator again. I want to see him just get hired by a first year head offensive head coach and just go destroy people as a defensive coordinator again. That's my ideal scenario. But I feel like if you're Mike Zimmer and you want to keep this job, you better make the playoffs.
Yeah,
but if you're a Vikings fan, I think I rather see it just be a clean break, and I'd rather see them just say, you know what, this is over. Like, it's run its course. There's been some really fun moments. Mike Zimmer was a very good NFL head coach, and the chance that he was finally given after deserving one for a really long time, we were consistently relevant. Our defense had real spikes of greatness. Like, there were definitely stretches over the last 5 or 6 years where the defense was special, transcendent, and those days are gone now. You know, your offense looks very good at times. You've had this very weird Kirk Cousins kind of experience. But I feel like sitting there and saying, all right, Justin Jefferson is a star. We drafted a left tackle in the first round. We still have Dalvin Cook. You know, what does the next phase of this look like? I think that's healthier for everyone involved. So if coming to terms with that path and timeline requires them missing the playoffs, then I think I'd be okay with them missing the playoffs.
I do have, like, when we talk about kind of like a long term, do you tear this down? Do you start over? Do you think it's realistic that they could move on from Kirk Cousins next year, given what his contract is? $35 million base salary, a $45 million cap hit, $45 million dead cap. So if you fire Mike Zimmer now, is the next head coach coming in, you're going to have one of those weird years where he's kind of married to Kirk Cousins? Like, would you maybe want just one more year to see if it would work with these guys? And then in 2023, you start over?
Potentially, man. But that's so
it's
difficult.
Gloomy. None of this is good.
I mean, it's so, so difficult. You look at it, I mean, their financial situation next year is not ideal. If you look at it right now, they're slated to be $7 million over the cap, and that's with both of their, all three of their starting cornerbacks,
and that's
hitting free agency.
$208 million. That's like with this expanded cap. Yeah, that's not great.
It's really rough. I mean, they tried to push it all in, man. They tried to say, like, all right, let's see if we can squeeze the most we can possibly out of this. I mean, there are contracts they can move on from, you know, that would get them where they need to go. But, and that's why I think that it probably is time. You know, you move on from guys that are drifting into their 30s, and whether that's Adam Thielen, whether that's Harrison Smith, you know, Michael Pierce is a contract that they can get out from under relatively easily. There are answers here. There are not good answers, and you're going to have to take a step backward before you take a step forward. But I think that sitting where they are right now in this weird middle ground, no man's land purgatory, that doesn't feel like the answer either. The Kirk thing, it feels like they would have to eat some of that to get rid of him. But if they're willing to eat some of it, and you have, let's say you can get that down to 25, a team would take that. Like, a team would absolutely take that. You can pay Kirk Cousins $25 million as your starting quarterback and survive. And there are going to be teams. We're talking to Zach Jackson here in a bit about where the Browns might go. Every year, a couple teams that you're not thinking about need quarterback competency. And Kirk Cousins can give you that. So I don't think it's going to be as hard to trade as it might seem, even if they have to eat a little bit of it. But let's say that number goes from $45 million where it is now to the $10 million you're paying in bonus and, you know, half of the base salary. So it goes from 45 to 27. That's gives you a lot of room. That allows you to start operating again. So it's going to be a really, really knotty offseason. But I do think that there are more pathways than it might seem like right now.
Well, Vikings fans, come tweet us. Let us know if you want to make the playoffs or not. I want to know how you truly feel about this. So is this what you want this year? So let us know. Tweet both of us what your answer is.
All right. The last question we like to ask here. Do you really not want to play the Vikings right now? We hear that phrase all the time. You know, you don't want to play this team right now. Do you really not want to play the Vikings right now if they made the playoffs?
I mean, there's nothing about them that is like truly terrifying. I think in the fact that they are so volatile, and that if it's you get in a close game situation, which a lot of playoff games would be, I'd feel pretty good about my chances. But are we thinking, okay, so who are their other options if we're talking about the other wild cards? Do they scare you more than the 49ers? I'd much rather play the Vikings than the 49ers.
Correct. But the 49ers, I'm kind of penciling in.
Sure.
Okay. So if you're looking at the team sitting at 7-7, would you rather play the Vikings than the Eagles?
I think I'd rather play the Eagles because I just think the quarterback ceiling is higher with the Vikings, but
I think I'd rather play the Vikings right now because of just what the Eagles have tapped into offensively and that formula that they have. I think that formula that the Eagles have on offense is scarier than anything the Vikings can present to you.
I think that's fair.
Would you rather play the Vikings or the Saints?
Probably this. Oh God, this is hard because
it's hard. It's really hard
because the Saints just can't score at all.
But their defense has those games.
Good.
That is just a level of God, I really don't want to be here against the Saints defense that just feels a little bit different.
Yeah, because if you're like the Cowboys, right? Like if you're the Cowboys, you've got to feel good. Like, okay, we can score at least 17 points.
If I'm the Cowboys, I'd rather play the Vikings. I would rather avoid that Saints defense if I'm the Cowboys right now.
Yeah, I mean that Saints defense is terrifying.
The Cowboys can lose a 20-17 game against the Saints. They absolutely can. I know that game just happened, but Taysom Hill had his weird finger situation, all of that.
Yeah, it's
no
just
Alvin
this
Kamara.
Is yeah, it's going to be weird. I don't know.
It's tough.
NFC playoffs
it's
are going to be so weird.
It's whoever gets there, because right now, like if you're the Cowboys, have the number two seed, so that they're the team in question here. And I think I'd rather play the Vikings than the Saints if I were the Cowboys in this exact moment.
Yeah, probably because of just the exact matchups and stuff that you're going to get.
Oh, man. I cannot wait to just hate watch, but also love that 2-7 game, whatever it ends up looking like.
Is that going to be the Nickelodeon game?
I totally forgot about that.
Get some guys slimed.
Oh, God. All right. It's time for this week's appointment viewing for week 16, the things that we cannot wait to watch this weekend. Lindsay, what do you got for me?
All right, so I'm just running it back a couple weeks ago. Remember when we were really excited to watch Bills Patriots because of all the
and
really
we didn't
cool...
really get to watch
it. Yeah, it's because of all like the cool matchup stuff and everything that was at stake. And what we got was just like the weirdest game because of it was in like 70 mile an hour winds and gross, disgusting weather. So I'm just running it back. I'm excited to see this game. The stakes maybe aren't quite as high as they were exactly at that moment where could the Patriots overtake the Bills in the division and all that stuff. I think some of that stuff is still in play, but now I just want to see that we're going to get a real game. Although I will say I have not looked at the Foxborough forecast in depth. I mean, it's December in Foxborough. Like the weather could be crappy, but there is no way that it will be as...
It always seems to be awful.
Like, and it'll be windy.
There,
so. It'll be, you know, but it's not going to be like the type of wind where you literally cannot throw the ball because it will fall out of the sky or you can't kick in a certain direction because it'll shank so far in one direction. So I just want to see like, okay, what does Bill Belichick do now? What does Josh McDaniels do now? What is their game plan for Mac Jones? How does Brian Daboll adjust what they do with Josh Allen for this game? Do they take a different approach? So that's the game that I'm most looking forward to, I think, mostly because we just didn't get it. I feel like we were robbed of that Monday night game a couple weeks ago, and I'm just hoping that this one will kind of live up to the expectations that we had a couple weeks ago.
The Bills need this game.
Yeah.
I mean, right now they're the 7 seed. Luckily for them, the Ravens and the Bengals play one another. So even if they were to lose, one of those other teams would also fall to 8-7. But I mean, the Bills were a team, it looked like 5-6 weeks into the year, were the best team in the AFC. Now they're clinging to their lives in the AFC playoff picture. And I think for Buffalo, this is kind of a look yourself in the mirror game for the Bills, right? The way the Patriots beat them last time, you got to ask yourself some hard questions about the type of football team you are and you want to be. And I know it's one big run, and honestly, play in and play out, the Patriots running game was not that effective in that game. But I think a couple teams have pushed the Bills around this year. Are you going to let that happen again? What does this game look like? What kind of team are you moving forward? How do you define yourself? Like, those are going to be questions I think the Bills have to ask themselves this week and then into this offseason. And I'm excited to see what it looks like. I mean, that game is excellent. I'm very, very much looking forward to that one. Minus Colts Cardinals. I'm a sucker for Christmas football. I don't know. I just have always enjoyed it. Well, I was supposed to go on a trip. I was going to be on a plane when this game was happening. I am not anymore. So I get to actually kind of settle in and watch it with my family at my mom's house, kind of curled around the hearth in the house at that time of year. That's fun. I'm very much looking forward to that. And these guys, I mean, the Colts are rolling, right? We had a long conversation about Jonathan Taylor. He is much must-watch TV right now, the way that he is playing. Darius Leonard feels the same way. I mean, it feels like every single week he makes one or two ridiculous plays that just kind of leave you laughing. I've also been watching the in-season Hard Knocks, so I feel strangely invested in fringe aspects of this Colts team, like Bubba Bentrone getting blocked punts. So that's it for me. Like, it is a nationally televised game. I can be watching it with people I don't normally watch football with. I'm going to be locked into that one.
There's a ton at stake for the Cardinals.
Right, yeah.
Now too. I mean, they're just hoping that nobody watched the way that they played last week against the Lions.
Oh, I watched
nobody
it.
I watched it too, and it was rough. Like, it was not great. And look, Kyler Murray tends to do kind of exciting things on a big stage. This is their moment. He is now out of the MVP conversation. I formally jinxed that when I wrote heading into Monday Night Football about what he could do to get back in. So I apologize to Kyler Murray for that. But this is kind of a huge moment to get the Cardinals back on track and show people that they're not the same old Cardinals, that this season isn't just going to wilt away. And the Rams, you know, the Rams are charging right now in that division. So a ton at stake for both of these teams. And it's going to be really fun. And I will allow my daughter to watch that game on Christmas.
You can't hurt me anymore with the Bears stuff. I'm not sad. I'm not sad. I'm not hurt. All right. Before we get to Zach, I need you to sell me on Thursday Night Football. This should not be too hard.
Yeah, we've got Niners, Titans, right? So Niners are really fun. Deebo Samuel, George Kittle, And that's honestly enough for me. That's really all I need is Deebo Samuel.
Oh, they're in that place.
And George Kittle. Like
their offense is so fun and so good right now that those guys are worth the price of admission on their own.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly soured on the Titans, but they're absolutely right in the mix. They're still leading that division. They've got a playoff spot as it stands right now. So they have a ton at stake. So I think this is a really interesting matchup. You know, you have to kind of go down the tree now, right? That this was a Shanahan to LaFleur, who then left, and then Arthur Smith. And then, so this is kind of like a Shanahan offense four times removed that the Titans are running. So there's kind of some fun schematic stuff here. But look, I'm just watching I want to see George Kittle like pancake some dudes. And I want to see Deebo Samuel like in the backfield and making guys look silly. So that's it. That's all I need for Thursday Night Football is a couple big stars, and we got that.
I will be watching. This 49ers team is very exciting and very entertaining to me. And I'm glad we've kind of come back around on the Kyle Shanahan arc, where it's like, hey, you know what? No, he actually is very good at
this.
We
no longer think he should just be an offensive coordinator.
Yeah, I'm good. If whatever missteps they make every once in a while in personnel ultimately lead to whatever we're watching right now, that trade-off to me as a football watcher and as a 49ers fan, I am willing to live with it. I think that's worth it.
I guess I probably wasn't fair to the Titans here. I will say the one thing is that they tend to surprise us. They tend to come up big in some of these moments. I mean, they've lost some bad games. You know, they lost last week, but I think
the fact that nobody watched that game is that's a blessing for the Titans.
Yeah. So I think this could be a good moment for them, and maybe they'll surprise us and make this a really interesting competitive game.
Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. For their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/maze, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/maze now to grow your business, no matter which stage you're in. shopify.com/maze.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
All right, it's time now for this week's team visit with our Browns writer, Zach Jackson. Zach, how you doing, man? Thank you for doing this.
good. So when you saw you in August, you were like, we're going to have you on right before the playoffs because the Browns were supposed to be there. So, no, anyway, it's a pleasure to be here with you guys. It's been a wild season. It's been the last week has been a wild year, right? And the Browns are not dead. So we'll see what happens these next few weeks.
Let's dig into some of that in a second. I want to start with whatever relevant COVID information is happening right now, because I feel like that's where we have to start every conversation at this stage of the season, which no one is happy about. But with this team especially, it has been an eventful week. So where are we with who's in, who's out? How healthy will they be for the home stretch? How healthy will they be for Saturday's game? They're playing on Christmas, so most of you will be watching the Browns this week. Just kind of lay all that out for me.
Okay, so 72 hours from kickoff is basically when we're having this conversation, and only 48 hours removed from the game where they had 18 active roster players on the COVID list. So if you use 10 days, Robert, as the threshold or the guiding point, all but three of them will be eligible to play by Saturday. The issue would be Baker Mayfield is in the group that maybe day 10 wouldn't be till Saturday morning. So he would be flying in on his own or with two or four teammates, having had no practice. Now, they only have one practice this week anyway, but they're looking at a situation where Clowney is still on COVID. The left tackle, Jedrick Wills, is still on COVID. Jarvis Landry is still on COVID. They think he'll be off. Myles Garrett is hurt. Kareem Hunt is hurt. Troy Hill is hurt. So the answer right now is they're probably going to be shorthanded and maybe significantly so, but they don't expect it to be anywhere near of the 18 guys, and they do at least hold out optimism that either Keenum or Baker, probably Baker, will be eligible to play. It just then comes down to, you know, how ready and what kind of plan have they been able to put together to get guys to play a national TV game on Christmas Day.
So why has Baker been out so long? What are the considerations there?
So with all the new protocols? 10 days is when you generally can test off unless you're asymptomatic, right?
Okay.
So he went on last Wednesday, so that would put this coming Saturday as the 10 days.
So he is symptomatic. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's why he hasn't tested out until now. So They got Austin Hooper back. They got John Johnson back for the game, and then he got hurt. It's just been one thing after another. And you know,
oh, boy, has it.
Yes. Yeah, so this is a team that wanted to run the ball and rely on its offensive line and let the defense loose. And they had lost the run game and really all offensive mojo about the time the defense got hot. And then Clowney went down. And if, you know, Myles Garrett has said he's going to play, but he's got what we believe to be a pretty significant groin injury. The linebackers have been in and out of the lineup, and they played last game without five of their top seven defensive backs.
All right, before we get into a lot of there's a lot of X's and O's stuff going on here, I think, and a lot of, you know, kind of, we can hone in on a lot of things. I'd love for you to kind of take us inside. Like, what does it feel like in Cleveland right now with the expectations for this team? And look, it's Christmas week and the Browns are relevant. They are in this playoff hunt. I think a lot of us maybe had higher expectations. How would you kind of assess kind of where the Browns are at right now and how they're feeling and maybe the fan base is feeling about where they're at this point in the season?
Yeah, Lindsay, 3 days ago even, I would have said angst more than anything else. I think it's frustration because they are alive in the playoff race, but they need so much help now. And some of that's an assumption that they're not going to beat the Packers, but I think everybody assumes they're going to beat the Packers. And let's be clear, outside of Ward, Clowney, and Garrett, this team has done nothing to resemble a playoff team. They just haven't. So to the fan base, this is the second time in 3 years that the Browns have had lofty expectations and completely flopped. So go back to 2019. That was the Freddie Kitchens year. That was a completely different regime, right? That's not the same. But last year's team just seemed to handle everything so well, the COVID stuff, just the strange circumstances. They showed up. They were disciplined. They were prepared. And the offense in the second half of the year got hot. And it was good enough to carry them to the second round of the playoffs, really for the first time since most of the players were born. This year, in the second half of the season, the offense has totally flatlined. The inconsistencies have been across the board, and they've included injuries, COVID, quarterback, you know, other guys that this team was counting on, the Odell Beckham quitting the team saga in the middle of the year, right? And you're left with a team that's really gotten hot defensively, but has lost even those guys that have led the charge. And they've scored 14 total points, 2 touchdowns in the fourth quarter in the last 9 games. So they've lost close games. They've lost COVID games. They've only been flattened once, but they just, even when they've won, like, they haven't impressed. So the overall feeling is frustration and that this season is a total flop. So it's going to be on these guys, Barry and Stefanski specifically, who were the darlings of the city and the saviors. The resurrection had finally happened. You know, they have difficult decisions lie ahead, and they're eventually going to have to parse through what just went a little bit wrong, what is, you know, goes wrong in the course of the football season, and where maybe are we flawed in the building. And then, of course, the big thing is Baker plays next year on the fifth-year option. He's been bad. He's been hurt. And what are you going to do at that position?
Oh, we'll get there. Oh, we will get there. Before we do, let's talk about kind of that disappointment a little bit. What's been the most disappointing part of this, beyond just the outcomes? Because I think you could take that a bunch of different directions, right? Baker's lack of ascension, the not being able to kind of fit Odell into what they're doing, whatever reported discord there's been with the quarterback and the way that the offense looks, the fact that the drop back passing game looks a little bit broken, they don't have as many answers there, some of the lack of defensive development. I think you could go a bunch of different directions on where this has fallen the most flat. And I'm wondering what you would say.
I would just point to 21st in scoring. This offense brought everybody back. This offense had different dimensions and a little bit of depth and really proven players, you know, and now it's like they can't do anything. So that to me is the biggest frustration. It's the most puzzling thing. You know, last year, once the coach and the quarterback got comfortable with each other and the flow of things, they really got aggressive with the pass game, and that opened everything else up. This year, the bread and butter is still running. You know, the running backs have been in and out of the lineup. Jack Conklin's been mostly out of the lineup. But there's been nothing but short passes, and they have failed really in so many third downs and in so many fourth quarters. They just, every time they've needed a big play, they haven't done it. And that has manifested itself at the end of halves, the end of games, you know, chances to put teams away, chances to rally and win. You know, they had a 45-point fourth quarter, them and the Chargers combined, way back in week 5. And they lost the game, but it was like, man, these are two really good teams, you know, really talented, young, rising teams. And since then is the stat that I mentioned, 2 touchdowns in the fourth quarter. They just – the offense has not had it in any kind of way. And that has – it's dampened the defensive efforts. It's magnified the struggles of the special teams, of all the guys in and off the various injured lists. And it's why they're 500 with what we thought was a, you know, top 5, top 8 roster in this league.
You said coming in, you said that the last year, the quarterback and the head coach getting on the same page and getting comfortable with each other was a huge part of this. Where do you think they sit? Their relationship, the way that Stefanski sees Baker. My understanding and just outside in reading this situation was always the company line there was good enough to win with. Baker is good enough for us to win with. I'm wondering where you think it sits now and kind of how they're looking at each other, both sides.
Well, you know, I'm speaking for both of them, and that's difficult because Stefanski doesn't ever give us an honest answer on a question. And Baker, after one game, chose not to speak at all. But Robert, I think when you watch, I think the play calling and the head coach's demeanor tells you that he's telling someone that the quarterback's not good enough. I just think that has happened. And anybody who's been hard on Baker, and I'm at the front of that line, can point to the receivers can't get open. The line hasn't been, the overall operation has not been what it's been, right? I think they've only played 4 or 5 games where Hunt and Chubb have both been completely healthy and they've scored
and
over
the 28 line,
points.
Right? Yes. I mean, the line has just been so dinged up. And even like watching Wills when he's been in the game, he doesn't look like the same guy. It just, and right, this happens. Injuries along the offensive line, they were healthy last year. It was a huge part of why they sustained success is because of the health they had, in particular that area. And all of that kind of stuff changes from year to year. You can't rely on health. But when you're looking at it, there are just so many different ingredients in whatever this end result of offensive disappointment is.
You know, last year when they really needed to make a throw, Jarvis Landry got open, he caught the ball, and then he made at least the first guy miss. You know, he got hurt in week 2, came back, got hurt again, has not been the same player. Peoples-Jones has shown a couple of flashes of being a really gifted young receiver. He has not been consistent. The tight ends, I mean, Austin Hooper blocks his butt off and is a big target, and he runs 4 yards and falls down. Like they want Stefanski wants to run a three tight end offense, and there is no pop there. Njoku has some pop, but you never know if he's going to catch it. So, yeah, like you said last year, the blocking, the running, the misdirection, everything just resulted in this groove that they hit, and they could attack you in different ways and keep you guessing. And this year, it's like they're the ones guessing, like, what should we even do? You know, he wants to be a fourth down, go for it team. I think of the eight first downs early in the season, or fourth downs they tried to convert early in the season, they got sacked on six of them, right? So that's not all on one person. There's a fundamental flaw there. I just think it's clear that there's not full trust in the quarterback, and there's nowhere near whatever that was, whatever, you know, shifting gears, pressing a button, whatever cliche you want to use, they can't find that button. And haven't really since early October, and now it's Christmas.
Before we get into too many of the off-season considerations, and Baker Mayfield is going to be a huge part of that, I want to get into kind of what's at stake right now, because the Browns are very much still alive. Somehow they're still alive. They're at 7-7. And had they won that game against the Raiders on Monday night, they would have been in first place in the division. But by the way, because of the way the NFC or AFC North, excuse me, is falling this year, they're now in last place. So can you take us through, as well as you can, because it is very complicated, what's at stake right now for the Browns this week against the Packers? And then what is their path to potentially climbing their way back into the playoffs?
Yeah, so, you know, it's down to 30% or so, but it's realistic because of the rest of the division. And it's probably down to like 6% that they would get a wild card. So, Lindsay, they need to win the division, which means they need to stack some wins. And then they finish at Pittsburgh on a Monday night, a game they absolutely can win. And at home against the Bengals, where, you know, the Bengals are obviously good, they're young, and Baker has owned them throughout his short career. So, you know, what else is at stake? Well, you know, Baker playing a national TV game that they really need to win this week, coming off this. Like, is he really the ultimate overcomer? Does this offense have an A effort in it? Because it hasn't shown it. You know, does Jarvis get back, and do they click? We know Kareem Hunt's not going to be there this week, and that is a big loss because he does so much. But I think in the second half against the Raiders, I think you saw Nick Chubb running, you know, the way he's capable of. He is a super rare back. The offensive line, they had to shift guys around, but I think they finally got some push and they got some flow to things. And then, you know, defensively, we don't know who's going to be there because Clowney's on COVID, Tack McKinley's out for the year, and Miles is hurt. But obviously, when you go to Lambeau, there's a lot to stop there. So it's in the division, they don't necessarily need to win this game. If the Steelers lose to the Chiefs, if the Ravens, if the Bengals beat the Ravens this week, and the Ravens, they've left it to the ifs, I guess, is what I'm saying. For them, though, I really mean it. Like, since probably the beginning of November, each week they've alternated third and fourth place in the division, depending on the other results. And just for much of the year, they've played fourth place football. Like, they just have continually not put even 2.5 or 3 good quarters together. And every time they've kind of had a breakthrough, whether it was one game and carrying that momentum or one really good push and time to slam the door on somebody, they just have failed. And it's been maddening. It's a completely different looking team, just in their operation, in the way they execute in quarters 3 and 4 than they were last season.
I wanted to talk to you about the defense because, you know, you mentioned McKinley, Clowney, Garrett. It seemed like at the beginning of the year that this pass rush was going to be terrifying. You know, they were leading the league in a lot of certain pass rush metrics. I think that both Garrett and Clowney were in the top 7 in pressures like 5 or 6 weeks into the season. You know, their defense had some really promising moments. I remember breaking down the game that they had against the Vikings and be like, man, this group really feels like they could click by the end of the year. A lot of new pieces. You'd assume they would grow over time. I know injuries have been a part of it, but where is the defense kind of fallen short? And where do you think the tweaks need to happen on that side of the ball before we even get to the Baker question this offseason and moving forward for them to hit their ceiling?
Yeah, that's a really interesting and complicated one, Robert, because early to middle of the year, there were a ton of communication breakdowns at the back. And it was like, okay, they're new, but man, when it was happening in week 8, 9, 10, that was bad. They seem to have cleaned that up. They had a couple the other night late against the Raiders. Well, they had practice squad safeties in, so of course they had it then. There have been games, specifically the 2 Ravens games, where Clowney and Garrett have both shown up with their A game, and it's just dominant, right? They shut things down and force things. Denzel Ward, he had late October, early November, a little flare up of some back issues and hamstring issues. Since he's come back, he has absolutely been at the top of his game. So I think the defense has done well enough to make anyone believe that there's not going to be a coordinator change, that the core guys are here. And obviously it's complicated. Clowney's going to be 29 and he's going to want $12 million. But I think the defense has taken the kind of jump that the offense took last year, where it was like, okay, we're almost at Thanksgiving. It's time to put the crap aside and put out a good product. And they have mostly done that. And you mentioned really dominant product back in Minnesota, both games in Baltimore, you know, a couple of other times. It's just offensively, they haven't. And really the other night's kind of summed it up. They didn't have their guys, but each side of the ball, including the special teams, the kickers missed 5 of his last 7, had one, you know, kind of untimely breakdown. And that was enough because they just don't score enough to give themselves any margin for error.
It feels like next year could be a huge jump for them. You know, we've seen this happen with defenses in the past, right? Where you have this massive turnover of personnel and you do make some incremental gains. I think they're 15th in defensive DVOA after being in the bottom third of the league last year. They've been hurt. But you think about it next year, obviously the Clowney question is an important one. But having JOK in his second season, having Miles be what he is, you still have most of the secondary coming back intact. It's kind of what it feels like to me. Maybe I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. But I think if you're trying to build this, this Browns team feels like the perfect example of this. And obviously the Baker question is a whole different thing. But we have this trajectory of teams where you have a jump in 1 year that maybe is a little bit of a mirage. There's certain luck elements to it, certain health elements to it. And it comes with these huge outside expectations and you're a little bit disappointed. And then in year three, it almost has a bump back to where you expected them to be in year two. And on defense, that's kind of what it feels like with this team.
You know, time will tell if you're right, but the case you lay out, I can't argue with. And I'm the dummy for not mentioning JOK earlier, because I think he kind of was feeling his way early in the season. And then he had an ankle, missed 3 or 4 games, but he is just so fast. And he dropped to 52 in the draft because he wasn't for everybody, but he was for this defense because of his range, right? They envisioned Garrett and Clowney just wrecking and demanding so much attention up front that a guy could come running behind and clean up plays or close plays. And that's what JOK has done. You know, Grant Delpit's a second-year player who's really a rookie. He's only had one game where he's played full-time. You see it there. The rookie corner, Greg Newsome, he's been out now. He looks really good. Greedy Williams has come in. You know, people wondered about him. He, the last month, has really played well. And you need 3 corners in this league. Hell, you need 5 corners in this league. So I agree. And I think, you know, going back to the Chiefs game week 1, the Chargers game week 5, it was like, okay, the Browns aren't there yet, but they're really good. And these are the types of games they're going to have to play. 31-28, 45-42. And eventually they'll figure it out. Eventually they'll close late. Eventually a bounce or a kick will go their way. Well, it's totally shifted. If the other team gets 20, the Browns aren't winning. So the defense has been good, and it has to be great, you know, until slash unless this offense can figure something out.
I've got one more defensive question here, and this is somewhat selfish of me because I have a vote for Defensive Player of the Year this year, and it is – a very weird year for this. So what is the case for Myles Garrett as somebody who has watched every single snap that he has played this year and over the course of his career? So what, you know, what would be the case for Garrett beyond just his sack numbers?
Yeah, Lindsay, I think he wants to win it. And had you asked me this question 4 to 6 weeks ago, I would say he's simply the most gifted guy and he's playing at the highest level. Like, you've seen him put more together this year. You've seen a more confident player in the way he carries himself, and you've seen a more dominant player in some of those big spots, right? When the Browns really needed a stop before the half, or when it was 3rd and 8 late in the third quarter and they could shift the momentum, he's done that. He gets doubled. It doesn't bother him, right? Quarterbacks run away from him, you know, not a bootleg, a sprint out, and he gets back there and he closes down. So I think you've just seen a more confident, stronger, and smarter player who has oodles of talent, and you've seen those moments. So, you know, since then, TJ Watt has come on and taken the sack lead, playing in fewer games. When I get to watch the Rams, I see Aaron Donald, and I say, oh my gosh, he still might be the best defensive player on the planet. But the case for Myles Garrett is that he has kind of harnessed this talent into you know, a matchup proof, a week proof. It obviously doesn't have 3 sacks every week like he had back in week 3. But in every single week, he impacts the game in multiple ways. And, you know, he'd done it before, but it was every other week or it was the occasional third down. And I think if you ask those who have played him consistently, you know, he has taken it to another notch with the consistency and just with the overall impact that he's made this year. You know, I'm talking about stuff that shows up and stuff that doesn't.
This could be one of those showcase type nights for him on Christmas night against the Packers. Obviously not an ideal situation that he's going to be playing through injury, but, you know, he could have one of those.
Yeah, he could. You know, obviously 2 years ago, he took himself out of the last 6 weeks of the thing. And he was going to be 18 or 20 sacks then before the incident happened. Last year, he got COVID and he came back and he was not the same player. So this year, I think he's slowed down a bit. In terms just how teams have blocked him, and he hasn't had a huge game in a few weeks. But I think in both Ravens games, and they had a scheduling quirk where they played back to back at the end of November and early in December, he and Clowney both just completely collapsed the pocket consistently in both of those games. So can he do it? Sure. He said immediately after the game Monday, he said, they're going to have to kill me. They're going to have to cut off my leg or I'll be there Saturday, because I think he thinks the same way as you. He's come out of his shell to us a little bit, Lindsay, and he will never come out and say, I want to win Defensive Player of the Year. But just in every, just in kind of the little things and the way he's put himself out there, I guess, he wants to do it. I just don't know right now, you know, 3 days, 2 days from kickoff, where he is health-wise. But I absolutely agree with your thinking that this could be, because the Browns need this game, and Saturday afternoon, everybody's going to be watching.
So let's have an off-season conversation, which is not at all a snake pit that I'm terrified to jump into. All right. If you look at this right now, it's kind of amazing. The Browns, as it currently stands, with a lot of the cap considerations and not making any moves, according to Over the Cap, will have about $39 million in cap space next year, which is a lot more than you would think, considering how we talked about this roster coming into the season. If you look at the guys potentially hitting free agency, they're not the guys you would really care about. They're not the guys you'd be worried about. David Njoku is a potential free agent. And a lot of the guys they had on one-year deals, right? The Tech McKinleys of the world, Malik Jackson, guys of that nature. With a couple moves, you would save $15 million moving on from Jarvis Landry and $6.5 million moving on from Case Keenum. You're looking at $60 million in cap space. The areas of the roster that we expected to be intact are the offensive line and the secondary. Those are places where they've made a lot of investments. Those are places they can build around moving forward. Other than that, and running back, obviously. Other than that, this team is kind of a blank slate in a lot of ways. There are a lot of different pivot points that they could go down. So just beyond the real estate and the financial resources they have to kind of play with in terms of reshaping the roster, you have the Baker Mayfield question. And also, some of that cap space would allow them to potentially chase a very expensive quarterback. So let's just take a step back and think about, if you're Andrew Berry and Kevin Stefanski, you get knocked out of the playoffs, you do not make the playoffs. It's February 15th. What is the biggest existential question that you have to ask yourself heading into this offseason?
Is our quarterback anywhere close as good enough as the guys that we're chasing down? That's to me what it is, Robert. One thing on the roster, not necessarily a correction, but one thing that could add to that, I'm not sure J.C. Treader's back, and that's $9 or $10 million more if sure. They need it, right? He's in his 30s now. He's injured all the time. They would like that. I think that sums up everything. I think when we had this conversation 3 months ago, you'd have said after the season, okay, the Browns are going to go draft a center. They're going to add a couple of young pass rushers, and they're going to be off and racing. Now they have a quarterback question. Now they have a bottom five receiving core in the league with a huge Jarvis Landry question looming, with the Donovan Peoples-Jones question looming. He's under contract, but he hasn't really taken that leap. Odell's been a non-factor. They drafted Schwartz last year. He looks like he can't play a lick, right? So, yeah, at quarterback, to me, it's not about – and again, I'm speaking for them here, and I don't know this. But I think they know that Baker's not good enough. I think it's – what is our option? Are we willing to go venture out into the wilderness for a year or two if we have to? Because we're not going to have Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt and Myles Garrett for too long. And we're not going to sign Jadeveon Clowney at age 29 to $12 more million if we don't think we can win the Super Bowl. We think we can win the Super Bowl. They've invested in the O-line, right? The secondary is really good. But the receiving core needs completely remade. And that quarterback question lingers. And so I think when you frame it like that, when the smoke finally clears in whatever week of January that it does, and they sit down and say, okay, how do we close this gap? How do we do this? It has to start with the quarterback, and it has to really probably start with plugging your nose and looking at some of these options. Because I don't know, you know, probably not is Aaron Rodgers going to become available. Probably not is a great quarterback going to fall into your lap in any direction. But I just don't see a path to where they're making a commitment to Baker Mayfield, or more importantly, you know, more urgently, I guess, to where they think they can really be a 12-win AFC championship team with Baker Mayfield.
All right. Let's talk about some of the potential options here. Okay. Kirk Cousins. Is he a better option in 2021, or excuse me, in 2022, when his base salary is $35 million, by the way, than Baker Mayfield?
Again, 4 months ago, I'd have told you absolutely no. Now I'm willing to listen.
That seems like the aisle we're shopping in here, though, right? Is the Kirk Cousins, Derek Carr.
Derek Carr is the one for me. Yes.
I think so, too. That's what I said. I said that a month and a half ago when we were talking to Mitch on the mailbag. That, to me, is the one that I would kick the tires on the hardest, because I feel like it's a direct upgrade. Financially, you could make it happen, and there is a world where you could spin the Raiders not wanting him as part of whatever rebuild they want to engage with. I think that Matthew Stafford is probably more talented than Derek Carr, but if I was trying to pick a Matthew Stafford-type figure that would be available in the same way this offseason, Derek Carr would be the name I would land on.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he fits what Stefanski wants to do, right? I agree. And so it comes down to what the Raiders want to do with him, obviously, in the year before his contract is up. But yeah, that's the one to me. That's way better than Matt Ryan, right?
What about Garoppolo?
Or Garoppolo. You know, I don't know what kind of upgrade those guys are. I know there's no history of going back to 2011 of a quarterback playing on his fifth-year option without a new deal and lasting with that team. So, you know, I think that kind of tells you something. So, we have seen really good Baker here in Cleveland. We have seen really bad Baker here in Cleveland. To me, what's in the middle is not close to good enough, so you have to go shopping. What you're going to find in these shopping aisles, I don't know. If it's Carr, I say do it. If it's those other options that we just quickly went through, I understand the angst.
Is there anything that can happen in these next 3 weeks that would change your mind on that or your view on Baker?
Lindsay, the easy answer is absolutely yes, but there's also nothing I've seen so far that makes me think that change is coming, right? And someone else asked me that yesterday, not someone as intelligent as you, and it kind of caught me off guard. So I'm a little bit more prepared here, but the Browns could still win. The Browns could get hot here, and he could direct them. I don't feel like that everyone has been on the same page. I think that's borne out in the results and in what we see on Sundays or Mondays or Tuesdays or whenever the hell they play these games, right? And I just look at the state of the offense, and I don't think that if they're down 10 with 10 minutes on Saturday evening, that there's any chance they come back. And I just don't think if they have to score 24 or 27 in one of those last two games in the cold on national TV to win and win the division or sneak in, however these things play out, I just don't see it happening. So maybe I'm wrong. And I do think that no final decision has been made anywhere, because I think internally you have to be focused on what's still ahead, right? And that's these last three games. But certainly nothing we've seen this season has indicated that's going to happen.
I just can't. I'm so intrigued by the setup when a new staff comes in and it's an arranged marriage with a quarterback they did not choose, and what the dynamics of that look like over time. Just think about how we've watched it play out in all of these different places over the last several years. Like Goff and McVay, and how it looked like it was rolling so well. It's like, oh yeah, we absolutely can win with him. Like, this is worth investing in. And then it just devolves so fast. And then you have this kind of honeymoon last year at the end of the season. We're like, oh, look at this. This absolutely could work. And then now here we are. And I always felt like that was kind of the creeping dread that they might have had organizationally, is looking at what happened with Goff and seeing how that all turned out and how it all kind of disintegrated, and wondering and hoping that wasn't going to happen. And it kind of has the same feel to me.
It has a very similar feel. And I think if, you know, when it got brought up back in the summer, right, when we were talking a lot of contract stuff, And it was like, well, they don't want to have happen to him what happened with Wentz and what happened with Goff. Well, at the time, you looked at last year and you said Baker's way better than those guys. Well, now you look now, the numbers are the same. The feel is the same, right? Like, those are all very different guys in very different situations. But the part where they were not very different is what you just mentioned. Arranged marriage, time to make a decision. Team looks good around them. Expectations are up. Goals are up. Time to go for it. And you have to at least go shopping in it. And I think I have zero doubt that they will. What the result will be, I don't know. And what could change about that shopping list or about how they prioritize the things they need or him himself over these next three games, I just don't have a lot of optimism that there would be a significant change in that regard.
Well, I'm sure everyone will respond rationally and patiently to all the things that we just said over the last half hour. Zach Jackson, always great to talk with you, my friend. Sincerely appreciate you taking the time out for us. Enjoy your Christmas in chilly, chilly Lambeau Field.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the way this thing's gone, the Browns will probably go 3-0, and we'll be talking in the playoffs here in about a month. But if that doesn't happen, thanks for having me. Talk to you guys soon.
Talk to you soon, man. All right, guys, that's all we got for today. As always, sincerely appreciate you listening. Thanks to Zach for the time. Always good to catch up with him. Thank you to Lindsay. We'll be back tomorrow with Nate and Sheil with our Week 16 preview and our Week 16 picks. Until then, please go leave a review of the podcast. Have it be a Christmas present to me. If you listen on Apple, just go let us know that you enjoy the show. If you listen on Spotify, you can rate the show. We'd really appreciate that. Also, please subscribe to The Athletic, theathletic.com/football show. If you need a last-minute Christmas gift for someone in your life that loves sports, I think that could be a really easy way to get it in under the wire here. We will be back. Until then, appreciate you guys listening. We'll talk to you later.
This was The Athletic Football Show.